host, Dr. Lorraine Hurley. My website is drhurley.net. Our guest this evening is Cynthia Sue Larson, and you know, she's a best-selling author, speaker, and intuitive life coach who helps people transform themselves from accidental manifestors into conscious reality shifters. Her two books that we've discussed on the program are Quantum Jumps and, of course, Reality Shifters. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, Lorraine. Oh, that's a great introduction.
Well, thanks.
I mean, you're hug.
Oh, thank you. And you're so accomplished. You know, while I was kind of waiting for the show to get started, I did go back to realityshifters.com and started reading some of the, you know, the 2013 testimonials, things that happened to people. And actually kind of remembered a couple of, I'm not going to bring them up now, but you take things that most people would just say is weird, and you basically ask them to consider that it's real at some level, that this happened, and it happened through means and ways that we can understand if we're willing to expand our perceptions of what's possible.
Right.
And that you've been doing this for a very long time.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah.
I guess when you're talking about the difference between 2000 and 2013 in those two surveys, I'm fascinated by the fact that this that we really have a stable body of evidence, you know, body of information that shows that people really are experiencing synchronicity, for example, at a pretty substantial rate, like something like 93-95% of the populace that was surveyed definitely experiences synchronicity, you know, very often. So that's just the beginning of what you might call reality shifting, and what I consider to be evidence of macroscopic scale quantum effects. In other words, that there's the quantum logic and the quantum paradigm is actually the predominant paradigm in reality, although it's not usually considered such.
Because we're not looking at it. I mean, we're just now beginning to see publications on, you know, quantum, you know, seeing doing biology, like quantum biology. We finally got scientists, we finally got people paying attention to the realization that quantum effects are everywhere around us, and what's been missing is our ability to perceive.
That's right.
And
yeah, so I think that's also a great way to just move into this whole subject of perception, and often we tend to assume that if you perceive something, that is reality, without recognizing that there's this entire method of interpreting what's perceived. So what's out there, you know, quote-unquote out there around us, is considered to be something that is real. It's hard for us to wrap our minds around the concept that there might be multiple parallel possible realities coexisting in this possibility range, and then occasionally we just lock one of them in. But we actually see evidence of such things when we recognize times of spontaneous remission of disease, or recognize an incidence of alternate histories. And a recent example of that the last couple of years is a lot of people noticing that Thanksgiving Thursday in America used to be the third Thursday of November. And just the last couple of years, it's actually now always been the fourth Thursday of every November. And when I say always, this is what happens when you move into recognition of an alternate history. Whatever reality you end up in typically makes it look like it's always been there. So it's kind of a good example.
It is a great example, and I'm getting that. This whole idea, and we don't want to, I don't want to get listeners, see it, I have this problem with Cynthia, I could just pick her brain from now to the day I die. She just gets me going. But when we're talking multiverses, you know what, we had an opportunity on the show very recently to talk about superposition and the fact that all possibilities exist simultaneously. However, probabilities become very, very important when we're looking at the bulk or the general average of consciousness on the planet. And I think this is what a lot of the consciousness movement is trying to is to convey to people, is that all possibilities exist. Let's consciously choose a particular probability. And instead of, you know, sitting down in front of TV and watching it and believing everything you see or hear, instead of being addicted to internet surfing where you're looking for, you know, you're basically just feeding a fear addiction. And that's not what everybody's doing. I've been there. I've done that. it's really learning to comprehend that where we put our attention and our time and the emotional energy of what we're experiencing is going to determine the probability of what happens. And right now we've got a media that wants, that seems to me, to want us to really perceive end times at some level or another. They're not talking apocalypse, but they just go on and on and on with what can possibly go wrong and what can possibly destroy us. And we know that certain things are being suppressed and certain things are being have become theater, false flags we call them. And when we start to open up to the realization that and I'm not going to say who or why. I don't know. I have my opinions, and that's all they are. I don't know anything. I just simply have to follow what I perceive to be true. It seems to me that there is something on the planet that really is marching us towards this probability of total annihilation, total destruction of the human being. Not just life, not just Gaia, not just life on the planet. And that's what we had agreed to talk about was artificial intelligence, because there people have some, this is going to be the pinnacle, quote, of our technological success. And people who are, in my opinion, not always serving the best interests of the masses are beginning to share their concerns.
Yeah, this has been in the news. So people might have noticed originally Stephen Hawking stepped forward and voiced a concern that artificial intelligence might take our jobs and could actually end up resulting in the end of mankind. And recently, then Bill Gates has joined him, and there's even been this sort of growing body of concern that was, I guess there's even some kind of a signed petition or a document where scientists are coming together to voice concerns that artificial intelligence needs to be controlled in some way. It's a letter, an open letter that says our AI systems must do what we want them to do. And it seems to advocate some kind of governmental control or something.
Well, I was going to say who are we talking about? We.
Yeah, I know. This is what's been in the news. But I think it's totally missing the real issue, oddly enough. It's interesting that open letter was expressed the way that it was, because to me, the problem is actually a little bigger than even the letter seems to be expressing, because control is something that we typically right now, when we think of computers, we think of artificial intelligence, we can't help it, but we're in the land of Boolean logic. Boolean logic is what we think is all that there is to logic. So when people talk about intuition is bogus because that's not logical, there's going to be a huge wake-up call for all of these people, and it's going to be happening soon, because what's about to happen is we're moving into a time when quantum logic that will be required for the new quantum computers, for the new quantum age, it's just like we're moving right out of the Stone Age into the Bronze Age, and it's happening right in front of us. This is going to be what's really driving AI forward. Because currently, even with nanobots and the current classical computer systems, artificial intelligence is not that big a threat. The threat, if you want to call it that, it comes when you bring in some amazing properties of quantum computing that we can see all around us in nature right now. You were mentioning quantum biology, and Nature magazine in 2011 had their cover story that this is the dawn of quantum biology. Indeed, it's the dawn of all of the sciences having the word quantum in front of them. Everything from statistics, quantum statistics, chemistry, cosmology. Yes, quantum cosmology. All these things definitely need to be considered with a quantum basis. And the logic that I'm talking about, this is where it gets kind of bizarre. Quantum logic has logic gates that allow time reversal. And so it means you can go through that gate and go left or right, and then decide, I didn't want to go left, I'm going to redo this maze. It's like you've got an eraser on the end of your pencil when you're working through a maze, and you always get exactly the correct answer. No mistakes. That's what nature
does. Yeah, hold on to your thoughts on quantum logic. We're taking a break. We're far more advanced than what most people realize. Of course, they're using them in institutions, corporations. they're not going to be something that the general public is going to have access to, I believe, until they learn to somehow attenuate, mitigate, or control what's possible with this. But let's talk for a moment about quantum logic, because this is actually an ability or a skill that individuals can acquire that helps them to negotiate this really super, you know, science fiction future that we're facing right now.
Right. So what I was talking about is maybe I should back up and talk about regular logic, that we tend to think in terms of you make a decision and then that decision is made. You go down a branch of that choice. And what this quantum computing is doing is it's bringing this whole idea of superposition of states, of all these possibilities that can coexist simultaneously, in which you might be sick and dying of cancer in one reality, in another one you're completely well, and so on and so forth. So all those possibilities are concurrent. And with a quantum logic gate, you can go back and forth through the gate. That sounds crazy. You know, we tend to think that time goes forward only, but it doesn't work that way in the quantum realm. And there is something that's known as bicausality. So the future can affect the past, and it's usually happening on a very small time scale. All of these quantum effects are most prevalent and most ubiquitous, most common, at a very tiny scale, tiny short time frames and tiny short distances. And so that's why, you know, the word quantum means that it's just an indivisible something. So when the quantum physics first came into being and the word was coined by the father of quantum physics, Max Planck, back in 1900, what he had in mind was that we would find the building blocks of reality. And then, of course, come to find out these building blocks are actually just as much pure energy as they are solid matter. And even weirder, there are things like spooky action at a distance, superposition of states, and now we're talking about quantum logic with being able to go back through these logic gates back in time.
But I actually have done a little research on changing the past. How do we, because like you said, we tend to perceive time as linear, right? And
right.
That what has happened is set in stone. You can't change the past. Everyone says, you can't change the past, you can just go forward. But there's a way in which we can live today. There's a way in which we can embrace and pursue the future that really does change the past. Some people will call it a function of interpretation. A lot of scientists are calling it actually a function of what you're calling, this breach of time-space continuum. If I misspeak, just go ahead. Please feel free to correct me, because this is such a phenomenal concept. This is such a phenomenal thing to consider. That with everything that's gone, you know, we watch TV, we read history books, we get up every day, and we think that what happened 40 years ago, as it's written in a history book, is the truth. Now, a lot of us question what's written in history books, but that's, you know, there's still this idea that things happened and the things that are today proceed from what has happened. You're really talking about the capability of reinterpreting or reworking the knowledge, the information we have today, to actually go back and change history and timelines. This is what reality shifting and quantum leaps are all about.
Right. I think of it as optimization, and really being, and to me it's similar to being an optimist. It's recognizing that there are optimal paths both for an individual and for all of the surroundings, you know, all the beings, plants, animals, people, and the earth that we love and care about. And when you feel equal respect for yourself and all of, you know, the others, people, plants, animals, and the earth, and clean water, clean air, and so on and so forth, when you're coming from that standpoint, it is possible that the optimal reality for all can be the optimal for yourself. Now, clearly, of course, sometimes people may question that and say, what about the plants that give up their lives to be eaten? But when it's recognized that they've lived a full life as a plant and it's time, that's part of their cycle of life.
Hold your spot, honey. We're going to break. Yeah, we're going to break. Listeners will be back in just a few moments.
Janice, close the door. Quit monkeying around. Don't you know it's cold outside?
Yeah, I do. That's why I'm going to Costa Rica.
Costa Rica?
Yeah, I heard about this Fibonacci Spawn Retreat on Dr. Lorraine Hurley's radio show, Uncommon Awareness.
Hey, I listen to her show on Monday mornings, right?
Yeah, she teaches us how to use sacred geometry to grow food and purify drinking water. Lorraine's hosting an all-inclusive nature and health retreat in Costa Rica. She's been there. She said you could swim with the dolphins and swing with monkeys in a treehouse.
A treehouse? Wow, that sounds magical.
Yeah, sleep in an elegant six-story treehouse in Costa Rica. It was featured on CNN. Look it up.
Okay, here it is on Google, treehouseincostarica.com. It says here, always 80 degrees, yummy seafood, pools, rivers, and waterfalls. Learn about ozone therapy and vortex gardening. They also have comfy beds and fun eco tours. Look here, Janice, it says the first people to sign up get to sleep in the treehouse.
Sounds perfect. Let's do it.
Costa Rica, here we come.
FIBOforum.com, FIBOforum.com.
Based upon the laws of quantum physics, of quantum logic, we need to be extraordinarily careful with where we take technology.
Thank you. Yeah, my thought about this new quantum age, I want people to know that what's really happening, as usual, is humans will be discovering the quantum science that's all around us in nature already. And I'm not going to go into too much detail about that. I describe quite a bit of it in my book, Quantum Jumps, talking about photosynthesis, the way plants can basically solve the equivalent of the rush hour traffic problem in New York City. Just by basically retracing their steps. These logic gates go back forward and backward through time so they can get the most efficient transfer mechanism for a photon of light to be transformed into energy, chemical energy the plant can then use and store. So that's a real flyby on nature and quantum logic, quantum paradigm, but it's all around us all the time. Now, I love this segue because this symposium that I attended at Stanford University was called by Douglas Hofstetter, who wrote that book about Gödel, Escher, and Bach. And he gathered together, at the time, some of the most strategic visionary scientists and business people in the field. He had eight guests who talked for 5 hours, and I do have a post on my website, Reality Shifters, about this. You can Google it. Just the name of the symposium was Will Spiritual Robots Replace Humanity? And so I wrote my observations of this symposium, and I think the folks, the experts that came included, they included Ralph Merkel, Bill Joy, Hans Moravec, Ray Kurzweil, he's the one that talks about that singularity, John Holland, Kevin Kelly, Frank Drake, and John Koza. So it was an extraordinary gathering of very thoughtful men. They were all men. But what I think was most interesting were some of the remarks that were made by one of the mobile robot research pioneers. That's Hans Moravec. And what he was saying is that he believes humans basically are an interpretation of this reality pattern, and we can model a person as being the same thing as an input-output device, just like a wind-up toy. And if there was such a thing as an ET that came down to Earth, an extraterrestrial, they might look at us that way. They might say, oh, these are just little wind-up toys. They have inputs, they have outputs, you know, they take what you give them and they process it, and then they say something or do something. Now, robots, Hans Moravec was saying, will naturally get that interpretation of humans because we'll see them that way. So robots will have thoughts and feelings because we will tell them of these things, and they will insist that they do have feelings and beliefs too. And so when Moravec was saying all these things, he was basically summarizing the whole point he was making is the fact that physical reality itself is just a way of looking at things. We don't really physically exist. We only think we do. And then this whole subject that the symposium was addressing about the possibility of deranged robots running amok, what Hans Moravec said was, I worry about robots getting strange beliefs by accident. I suggest there should be policing system among themselves. It's fully possible for machines to go crazy. Now, this is a mobile mobile robot researcher, so he knows they can go crazy. But he said you need to just build in some safeguards inside them. So it's an interesting, I think that was a great take on the whole subject. I love the input-output model. And when I look at some of the current research that's happening just in the last few years, because this symposium happened back in the year 2000, and now, more currently, we actually have a situation where we've got researchers such as UC Irvine's Donald Hoffman, who's a visual scientist, and he's actually got a theory that everything, all layers of consciousness, are basically input-output connections. And he works in the field of perceptual recognition, of the biology of perception, and what he's coming to is this viewpoint that reality is very much like when you look at your laptop or your iPad or something, and you see icons on the screen, and you know that there's a trash icon, and you can put something in the trash, and it goes there. What Donald Hoffman is saying is that's pretty much the same thing that happens in reality. That's the way all of our senses work. We think things are out there, but they're not. We're just touching and feeling and holding and sensing things that are basically icons. They're not real. So this matches the perennial tradition. If you are one of those people that has looked at the idea that life is just a dream and that everything that we think is real is just maya, just illusion, there's a lot of physical basis for that from some of the top researchers and scientists right now. And this does tie into the artificial intelligence concept, because these are key points to recognize that when you've got artificial intelligence, it will, as soon as you bring in the quantum computing and the quantum logic, you will have beings that are very natural. Right now it's a joke to think that anything that's even like our computers today could ever fool us into thinking it's conscious. That's true. But we haven't seen quantum computers yet. And that's where everything is about to change. And that's really the reason that people like Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking and the others are quite concerned, actually, because they realize that what we thought was computing is about to be completely revolutionized in a way that's hard to predict and will be bringing us into a level playing field where the robots actually might even get the upper hand. And that raises the next question of how do we raise them correctly? You know, is it enough just to have a government body policing it? I would say no. I don't think that's nearly enough. I think it's inadequate. And that's like saying that the government will raise our children, you know?
That's right. And frankly, and this is my opinion, not Cynthia's, the government is completely out of control. So there's, Cynthia, from my worldview, from my point of view, the mainstream institutions that define our lives have already instituted a tremendous amount of control. And they do this through the media, they do this through education, primarily the media and education. We're already seeing kind of a robotizing effort towards,
right.
Thank you, towards what's going on with humankind. And the work that you do and the work that I'm trying to do really says to people, wake up and appreciate that at this point in time, we are functioning much as robots if we do not question, if we do not take that leap of imagination, of creation, of visualization. We are following a program. We are programmed. So at some level, we may not be robots or computers, but because of the way that we're structured as human beings, we can be programmed. And this is what's happening.
Yeah, and it happens very sneakily. It's like the boiled frog syndrome, where you get a GPS device and it makes it easy to navigate through a city, so you don't need to ask directions or figure out where you are. You can just trust that the device is guiding you through properly. And most people I know don't remember phone numbers anymore because their phone has it pre-programmed and so on and so forth. So that none of those things are all that bad in and of themselves. Like what I mean by the boiled frog syndrome is that over time, the more we start handing over our decision-making capability to artificial intelligence, the more we lose that sense of what it is to be human, what it is to have an intuition, to have a creative idea, to spontaneously make a choice to go a different route. So So if you've got that GPS device and you decide, I'm going to wing it, I'm going to see if I can figure this city out on my own, I'm going to see if I can figure out kind of where I am based on where the sun is and so forth, that's a very good thing to do. You might show up late. You might make some wrong turns. So what? You know, that's part of the fun and the process. So the problem, as I see it, it's a very stealthy problem. It's not just the government. It's actually all of those ways and times and places that humans give up our thinking, our decision-making, because it's just too much effort. And at first, it's little things, and it doesn't matter. But when it starts turning into who you vote for and what you are choosing in terms of the way everything is working, then it becomes a big deal.
It does become a big deal, because that's what we're talking kind of about, what we'd call a singularity. Now, I want to just share something with you in the last few moments of this segment. I have a correspondent, he writes me regularly. He was listening to the Power Hour, and Joyce Briley was talking about trains, an advertisement for trains, and he emailed her, and he got a response back. Here's the whole point I'm trying to make, is that he got a response to his, you know, email inquiry, what's going on with the trains. His way of thinking, his world, is that they're trying to take us to FEMA camps. They're basically conditioning us to accept, because we don't really use trains as a primary method of transportation these days. So he was talking about Brock. He basically said he only calls him Mark. He doesn't. So you always have to be careful. Lockdown. He's talking about cars from the point of 2005 have trackable technology. And then he ties it into the Cash for Clunkers program, which was about taking as many clunkers off the road as possible because they did not have these electronic controls. And he talks about what these electronic controls really can do. They can actually force a car to go in a particular direction when you, the driver, choose not to. They can set off airbags. He's got this whole list here. I'm not going to go into it.
They can cut off the braking system, too. You can lose your braking completely. These are easily hackable, too.
He's talking about why would the government basically be promoting cars on the road, all these hackable cars on the road. Because of my worldview, which is very, very cynical towards the government, again, these may not be Cynthia's views, they're mine, it's beginning to make sense, a lot of things. Whenever something comes out in the mainstream, always consider what it is they're really trying to communicate. That's where I've gotten. We'll be back in just a few moments. So the more we allow technology to guide our decisions, the less present we are to spontaneity or presence itself. I think that's what you were saying, is that we can really allow ourselves to become a slave to technology and check out from the moment-to-moment choices that are available to us.
That's right. And that's mentioning, I was using examples from today's technology so people can have a reference point and get a sense of what it might feel like, kind of imagining forward when artificial intelligence does get to a level where it has some autonomy, which currently there's no trace of that. You don't look around and see like a smart car driving itself and deciding like it's time to take you to work, and then your alarm goes off and all the systems guide you into the car, so you're treated like an infant or something. That hasn't happened yet, but that is kind of the direction things are going, oddly enough. So even though we don't yet have any evidence of autonomous systems acting on their own initiative, what I'm saying is that with quantum computing on the horizon, we're not that far from getting to that place, that fork in the road, where if we haven't done a good job of educating and pre-programming a sense of respect for all beings into that artificial intelligence, if we don't bring ethics into the equation soon enough, that is when we can get ourselves into a very dangerous situation, as well as if we don't recognize that by treating ourselves like babies, basically. You know, do we really want to be like infants, where our every need is anticipated and dealt with before we even noticed we were hungry, or that we needed to exercise, or that we needed sleep, and so forth? That's where the danger starts happening. And so even though that may seem like it's a whole future that you can't even imagine, it's good to think in terms of, well, what's happening right now? We and to add to what you said, I love that example, Lorraine, about the cars that are smart cars. Anytime you put that that word smart, I'd put quotes around it, it's not really smart. It's just usually most of these devices, like smart TVs, they're data-gathering devices that can listen in on conversations, pick up keywords, and then data mine, you know, they still start doing voice recognition, don't know who's saying what in front of the TV and so forth. So this is not science fiction. This is here. You know, that technology is here right now. And if you're ever being told to get rid of your old equipment, you should get rid of your old landline phone, you should get a new smart TV, smart car, smart this, smart that, I'd say don't. You know, I take a look at it, make a decision for yourself. But really, what's the trade-off here? And think about it. So that's what I would recommend, is really being thoughtful.
Well, it's like smart meters. You know, there's this huge campaign to simply have a right not to have a, quote, smart meter on your home. You're right, they use that word smart. When it comes to cars, you know, can they simply send a signal from a satellite that's going to shut down cars? Say people are attempting to flee a particular area due to some circumstance, right? They're all on the road.
Besides, we don't want them leaving. Let's shut them down. Yeah.
That's right. And so you do share my cynicism,
yeah.
My distrust.
I have a background in information technology, so I worked for a large financial institution doing data security. So, yes, I'm very fully aware of these things. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but here's something that we'll just bring up, because I want to go into some of the more futuristic aspects of artificial intelligence with the time that we have left in the first hour. I just want to ask Cynthia to consider, most of us, I'm of an age, I'm 55, right? And I'm of an age where technology is increasing so fast, it actually irritates me. It's actually turning me off. I can't keep up, right? People are like, well, just do this, 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 or that, you know, to do this, 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 or that. And I'm kind of sitting back saying to myself, I can't keep up. But we do have this younger generation that seems to be particularly drawn and particularly focused and particularly capable with the new technologies. So there is this kind of generational gap. The younger generation is kind of being indoctrinated into a really strong reliance upon technology.
Right. Yeah, this is amazing, because I don't think there's been any generation. I mean, we always say this, right, that each new generation is so different than all the rest. But this, there really is something to it this time because of the technology that you're describing. And anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about can just go to some place where young people in their teens and 20s are gathering, and chances are that you'll notice a lot of them typing on their little devices, texting, you know, listening to music and so forth, relying upon this little device for everything, whether it's taking a picture, and there's an app for that, is this common phrase, and if you haven't heard it, then that's amazing, because nowadays, you know, pretty much all of the young people are very, that's just part of who they are. They consider their iPhone or their little smartphone to be part of their identity and part of their availability. I don't know too many young people today that turn that thing off or take a few days away from it. That would be most unusual. But I would recommend, if anybody who has been living that kind of lifestyle is listening to us, if they're starting to think, maybe, what would it be like? Could I walk away from it for a few days? I would recommend doing just that, you know, walk away from it. I did that last weekend. I took 4 days away from my internet, which is how I run my business, and I don't have a cell phone, but just walking away from the internet for that many days felt terrific. You know, it's such a wonderful feeling to be experiencing reality without that constant interruption of emails and messages and social media and all that stuff.
Well, and this is the whole thing, the social media. Right now in my life, I'm going to be taking 2 weeks off after this week, listeners. Nitty Gritty Law Library and Jim Moran will be guest hosting for me, Dean Lloyd. Because what's happened is I can't, Cynthia, I can't even think clearly anymore. I've got so many demands on a daily basis that I haven't even been able to think about, where is this going? What am I doing? And for me, what I had to do is I had to get people to do some work for me for a couple of weeks so I could just really not have to deal with it and begin to think more clearly. And there are people in my life that just, are you okay? Well, I'm not okay. But you know what? It's okay that I'm not okay.
And what's amazing when you think about what this is doing to young people is they don't know the difference. Now we've got children that are getting involved in this 24/7, must be present, must be responsive world, and it's crazy making. So we've got young people that are actually getting depressed and feeling the same kind of stress you're describing, but they don't necessarily have words for it because they don't know what it's like to live differently.
Right, right. We're talking about some, you know, kind of the social aspects, psychic aspects towards people. We're not even talking about the environmental aspects. You know, I've got a good friend in Sweden, Ollie Johansson, who just sent out an email, The Science is In. With 20 years of exposure to wireless technologies, your risk for cancer increases threefold.
Because it's an environmental insult. Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, we're figuring it out, but of course, putting it aside is another issue. Let's just talk about, because here is where we're at. Here's where we're at. Here's what's going on. And I do really want to further elucidate your intelligence on artificial intelligence. But in Reality Shifters, let's take some examples of what people have experienced. And I've got that website right here. That really lets them know. You don't take these as, you know, oh, we can't explain them, too bad. You really look at this as the person went in and out of a reality. Right? They went from here to somewhere else
and
back.
The premise is that just as it may seem unlikely that you would often be experiencing reality like a quantum particle, it's actually expected that occasionally you would. And that's most scientists today. There's a majority. Something like two-thirds of physicists who were recently polled indicated that they believe that we absolutely live in a superposition of states. That's you and me and every single person. So what they're saying is that each one of us is capable of and occasionally does experience what that feels like to experience all of these possibilities around us in the form of, for example, synchronicity. That's me saying, the synchronicity. That most physicists would not step as far out as I am stepping. The reason I'm doing it is because, like you say, I've been collecting firsthand reports, which are basically case histories, like you would see in medical histories, from people who report having seen things appear, disappear, transform, transport, and changes in the way they experience time, which also includes things like alternate histories, where people, famous personalities occasionally have been witnessed being dead, and then they are suddenly, you might notice that person is alive again, even though you heard a very reliable, believable report of their death.
Right.
And those kind of people would be like Jane Goodall, Nelson Mandela, lots of other people. So it's just a huge phenomenon, including things like this Thanksgiving Thursday moving from the third Thursday to the fourth. And, of course, there's no trace that it changed. It's just suddenly... it's different. So these are the kind of firsthand reports that I've been collecting for 16 years, doing surveys of hundreds of individuals to find out what kinds of reality shifts are most prevalent. And then in my book, Quantum Jumps, I also took a look at things like the placebo effect, where, for example, 97% of doctors right now are prescribing placebo because they're finding that there has been a doubling of the placebo effect just in the last 30 years, which is actually good news. It means that what used to be considered ineffective because there's no reason for a saline salt solution to do anything or a sugar pill to have any effect, We're now noticing that if the placebo group in a drug trial is given a saline injection or a sugar pill, it's very likely that they might see something like 30 to 40% positive results in reduction of pain or mobility increase and all kinds of things just from having that placebo. So this to me is further evidence that there's a very strong connection between what we expect to see around us and what's actually happening, that we actually are able to shift reality to make a quantum jump.
That's right, and I just want to take one here. Here, this is a story from a little girl that I love so much. Flowers, glasses, and whipping cream. My family experienced so many reality shifts when I was growing up that we began to suspect something of taking things, moving things, etc. Of course, there were the general accusations. I remember at the time little plastic flowers appeared in one of the house plants, and everyone thought I'd put them there. I was 6 at the time and had noticed the flowers there and wondered where they had come from. It felt so freaky to be accused of this that I was laughing nervously, which made my parents think I had really done it. Weird. My mother's glasses simply vanished off the top of the piano one day. My favorite instance, and certainly the most elaborate, was the time we went to get the big bowl of fresh whipped cream out of the refrigerator for the apple pie, and the bowl was gone. Gone. It was a really big bowl, the kind you have to hold in two hands with handles out at the sides, the kind of bowl you can hold in your arms. Of course, the accusations went around, the pleading, but when it was finally decided that nobody in the family had taken and hidden it, we simply ate the apple pie without the whipped cream. An hour later, my mother looked into the refrigerator to get something else, and there was a big bowl of whipped cream, and it was still cold. I mean, this doesn't sound like such a big deal, Cynthia, but this is the kind of thing you're talking about. We all
experience
exactly
that. Yeah. And I think I'm so glad you picked that example because it may jog the listener's memory, because often these sorts of experiences, it's like the X-Files. You don't know where to store such a memory. It's kind of like, well, that was weird. And then you can't, part of our minds, if we haven't heard of the reality shift or quantum jump phenomena, we just tuck it under, well, I don't know what to call that. And it kind of gets forgotten. And then when we start talking about it and talking with other people about it, listening to firsthand reports of these experiences, then you start noticing, I think that's happened to me. You know, it's really good to describe these commonplace everyday things.
It's really good, and in the context of artificial intelligence, what I want to point out is that artificial intelligence is very predictable. In other words, we're going to lose some of our ability to engage the world spontaneously, to move in and out of quantum realities, as we become more and more focused on artificial intelligence. Like you said, pretty soon we'll be treated as infants. You know, something will wake us up. There was this was about 2 years ago, a top CEO of some company, I mean, this man made millions of dollars. He had phones and internet, everything throughout his house. He was connected 100% of the time. And the woman that was doing the interviewing was basically kind of like saying to him, well, where's your life? Right? Where's your life? Is there no privacy? Is there no moment of escape? Listeners, we're taking a break. Cynthia, is there anything you want to add from the last segment? Because I just wanted to read that thing about Oedipus Rex.
Go ahead. Yeah, that's a fun one. That's good.
Yeah. I don't have it right. Just the story is a man was looking for a golden retriever. He'd always loved Irish setters. But they had a reputation for having become headstrong, highly strung, and overbred. So he thought he'd like to get an Irish setter golden retriever mix. And the more he was thinking about it, the more he was actually visualizing this dog. And he was having trouble finding one. There was just either setters or there were goldens. And he was, trying to, how do I find this mix that I just feel is in my life? So if he could ever find such a dog, he was going to name it Oedipus Rex, or Oedipus Rex, Rex for short. So after some time, he was working weekends as an apprentice, and he was working on a boat, and he picked up a paper that was left on the boat and found an article basically looking for a home for a 6-month-old puppy, half Irish setter, half golden retriever. And it was really strange to him that he would find the exact same thing he was looking for. Well, he called the number, and the woman answered the phone at the other end. She said, "Hello, this is PAWS." And he said, "Well, what does PAWS stand for?" "Pets are wonderful support. We're a support agency for people who have life-threatening illnesses and need help in keeping their pets." Now, what was this little puppy named? Rex. It turns out he belonged to a man that had AIDS and could no longer care for him, and so he had been put up for adoption. So his name was Rex, and the organization was PAWS, and he basically had set the vision for Oedipus Rex or Oedipus Rex, OEDI-PAWS Rex. You know, that just kind of gave me goosebumps because I thought, gosh, how many times in my life have I had those kinds of synchronicities, those kinds of miracles, really, and not given proper honor for them?
Yeah.
That's what I would say, proper honor for the fact that this was, you know, just the universe answering my thoughts, my intentions. My ideas.
I love that meaningfulness that seems to come through. Sometimes when people think synchronicity, they think that it doesn't have that level of meaning, or, you know, people who dismiss it and say that's just coincidence. But to me, coincidence, synchronicity, usually can be quite meaningful and can be giving you those goosebumps exactly for that reason, that it seems like there's this heart connection that you're feeling. And really, that's what I would call the basis of entanglement, where we obtain a state of coherence with ourselves, with others. And these are physics concepts that I'm taking out of the quantum small range and bringing right up to our daily life. So when you move together in harmony with an idea, such as we're moving toward a better future in which, you know, we can find dogs that we love just exactly as we need them. And so we don't need to be afraid of artificial intelligence, because we know that we'll be making sure ethics are part of the basis by which they're created. You know, that's where things can be good. And that's why I love that focus of how good can it get, so that we, even if we don't know what the maximum good is for all, we can kind of imagine that it must be possible and there must be some way that we can experience it.
Yeah. But let's go into kind of one of the areas where Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking are coming on board with concerns. We're talking about self-replicating artificial intelligence. This is very different, you know, than us building computers, putting...
On that basis, you mean self-replicating, like cloning, like physical cloning, right?
Right.
Right.
Isn't this a thing that people that are looking futuristically fear?
Well, as soon as you get into the field of consciousness, a fascinating thing occurs, and you'll find, at least currently, that no two researchers will agree on what they're talking about when they discuss consciousness. So at the very same time that we need to have a pretty good grip on this subject, we don't have it.
At all.
So,
yeah.
You know,
that's kind of like the nuclear experiment, right? We thought we knew what we were doing. Now that Fukushima's melting down, I guess we really didn't know what we were doing. We'll be back in just a few moments. Because we're not just talking artificial intelligence, we're talking about self-replication,
right,
of this intelligence. Do you want to comment on that?
Yes. Well, back at that conference that I attended, the symposium at Stanford that was called with these scientists, Bill Joy spoke up, and he made a statement, a very strong statement, that we need to step away, walk away from these very dangerous technologies of nanotechnology, genetic engineering, and robotics. Just like we relinquished the technological development of biological weapons, and we did so nation by nation, what Bill Joy is saying is we need to back away from this because it's too dangerous, and we simply are not set up to police it, manage it, or control it in any way, shape, or form. That these are this Pandora's box, basically. You know, these are weapons that these things can be weaponized, is what he was talking about. And he mentions a very real risk of unchecked self-replicating technologies that when you combine nanotechnology with genetic engineering, with robotics, you are now in the world of knowledge-enabled mass destruction, KEMD. So it's something we don't hear much about. I'm sure the government probably has a whole thick file on it, but most citizens are blissfully unaware of the risk. And you're right, this was something that was discussed back in 2000. It's 15 years later, and now we've started to get some books that are becoming bestsellers, such as Superintelligence, where Nick Bostrom is bringing up some of these same ideas and presenting it in such a clear way that people can start seeing, wow, now this is kind of scary stuff. So in a sense, that's good, because I think unless you realize there's a real and present danger, there can be kind of a sort of a naivete that can be quite dangerous, where we don't realize the risk of what we're getting into. And
the naivete, as far as I'm concerned, is trusting the government or the military to actually do anything good with this. That's me. That may not be your particular orientation. Were these technologies discussed and publicly supported? Were the companies that were creating the technologies transparent in terms of what was going on? It might be a different story. We could conceivably create artificial intelligence that would be certainly in service to humankind. The way that the power structure is working right now is that it seems as though everything is done to control the masses. So we're talking about this as though the intelligence itself can become self-replicating and out of control. But I think it's the controllers, the people that initially are responsible for propagating this technology, that are the ones that we have to worry about. And quite frankly, I don't trust the ethics, as you would say. I just call it ethics. I don't trust the ethics right now of government or the military enough to support their further development of these technologies. That's just me.
Right.
Not because I'm anti-technology, but
I don't know that any group would be trustworthy, even if you're saying corporations should have that control. I don't know. Probably not. I wouldn't gladly hand that over to corporations either. You know, would you trust
it comes down to what you called ethics. What is the overriding intention of the organization developing the technology? Are they really in service to humankind? Are they in service to their own profit, profitability and control capabilities? And right now, that's just the world we live in. There is sickness, this psychopathy.
Exactly. And when you look at history and notice the worst atrocities that have occurred, sometimes they've been done in the name of optimization. And so then who decides the ethics? Who decides what's optimal? Because we would not want some kind of ethnic cleansing to occur, obviously. So then how do we preserve the level of respect that we have for people of all persuasions and life forms of all types? How do we do a better job teaching artificial intelligence how to be a good shepherd, a good, just a caretaker for the planet when we humans have done a less than beautiful job of it? So this is a very difficult time. It's like becoming a parent and recognizing, I've got issues. I'm not really fully mature, and now I've got kids. And that's what's happening to humanity right now. You know, like it or not, we're just about to be pregnant with artificial intelligence, and we don't have our act together. So, but I do believe it's possible, and that's why I keep that focus on how good can it get, and recognizing and respecting diversity, just as we do in the environment. That's going to be the key to going forward, is looking to what has worked with indigenous peoples. I keep going back to that because that was the last time that humans really understood how to maintain balance between predators, prey, plants, animals, people, and ecosystems. And it's time to recognize we're about to teach artificial intelligence how to look after us and the whole planet, and we'd better get our act together.
Right.
And it is a matter of ethics.
Well, I just want to give you, I want to share a story with you. Drones are kind of one example of our kindergarten attempt at artificial intelligence. Would you agree? You don't have to man them. They can, they're computer organized, they're computer run. There's a man by the name of Mehran Keshi. He's formed a foundation and something called a plasma reactor, and nobody was interested. So he's Iranian, but he's a citizen of Belgium. so he sold it to the Iranian government, it took down two of our drones. And the American government very, very humbly asked for them back, right? They cost millions of dollars for each drone. And the way that it was taken down had to do not with artificial intelligence, because the drones are running, they're computerized. It was taken down with an understanding of magnetic and gravitational fields. We're kind of seeing this tension as as some organizations will step into a irresponsible proliferation of artificial intelligence. Other organizations are stepping into what I consider a more responsible response, if that makes sense. You can't do this. You can't impose this on people. You can't, you know, a drone flying over, this is a spy drone. This wasn't a destruct zone. But look at how we're utilizing non-human machinery to inflict extraordinary damage.
And to extract data that we've been talking about from all these smart devices. You know, is it okay for your smart car to be listening to your conversation, which you thought was private? Is it okay for there to be data mining of that conversation, or your cell phones listening to what you're saying? You know, and these things are happening already. And this is people's daily lives. It's not in some far-off country. It's right now, right here, happening. You know, is this okay? Where are the ethics? Are we going to wait till our attorneys figure it out? Are we going to let this get worked out in the court of law? Or are people going to wake up and say, wait a minute, I don't even know if I want this? You know, and then, of course, like you say, drones, which currently don't have a high level of autonomy, but as soon as quantum computing comes in, that will start changing. That's when it's going to, the tipping point will come, and you'll see, like, oh my gosh, it's true. Robots are, they're designing themselves now. As soon as that happens, we need to back up a little bit and get ethics in the equation beforehand and train artificial intelligence to be like us, and hopefully we can be better as parents and respecting other countries, people in our own countries, of all walks, of all classes of socioeconomic levels, right, without just conferring higher standards upon those who have more money, for example, which is a rather arbitrary thing, but to recognize that all people have rights. Are we doing that? And this is a huge challenge.
There's a film that you've probably seen, Johnny Depp. He's a genius that puts his consciousness into a computer. Oh God, I can't remember the name of the film now. Do you know what I'm talking about, Cynthia?
Yeah, I've heard of it. I haven't gotten a chance to see it yet, but it's
okay. So he does, and what happens? His consciousness within the computer doesn't stop being who he was as an individual. In other words, we're talking about a runaway computer system, exactly what they're talking about, runaway artificial intelligence, a computer managing a genius's mind. In the end, he has to die in order to shut down the computer, and he chooses to do so. And we're talking, now this is, you know, fiction and so forth. I can't remember the name of the film. But this is what we have to really begin to comprehend about artificial intelligence, is that it's only as capable as the intelligence that constructs it. Now, you're talking about quantum computers, which give us a whole new range, quantum leaps, you know, exponential range of possibilities. And yet at the same time, all of the intelligence that is possible within a computer is possible within the human being. I personally believe we should be working on human potential possibilities, because we do have the ability to be ethical and moral and compassionate and loving and kind and aware. We'll be back in just a few moments to wrap up the show. I think the point that both of us are hoping or trying to make is that anything that we can do through technology is actually a capability of human ingenuity. It's basically a human ability. We can't create anything that is greater than what we are ourselves. So when we talk about quantum computing, it really suggests that as human beings, we are capable of such abilities.
Right. And there are some amazing good indicators right now that people are waking up, such as the recent losses of profitability of Monsanto and that last quarter financial, you know, their profits went down 35%, probably in direct response from people's adverse reactions and feeling about genetically engineered foods. And similarly, McDonald's has been suffering a similar profit loss. And I'm not saying that's a good thing when companies suffer. What I'm saying is it looks like people are starting to wake up, that there's an increasing awareness amongst the general populace of the world, and even in America, where we're finally hitting a tipping point of about 10% of the populace meditating on a regular basis. That is giving us an advantage in